That evening, dining with Wesley Mooch in his own suite, Mr. Thompson glared angrily at a glass of tomato juice placed before him. "What? No grapefruit juice?" he snapped. His doctor had prescribed grapefruit juice as protection against an epidemic of colds. "No grapefruit juice," said the waiter with an odd kind of emphasis. "Fact is," said Mooch bleakly, "that a gang of raiders attacked a train at the Taggart Bridge on the Mississippi. They blew up the track and damaged the bridge. Nothing serious. It's being repaired. But all traffic is held up, and the trains from Arizona can't get through." "That's ridiculous. Aren't there any other?" Mr. Thompson stopped. He knew that there were no other railroad bridges across the Mississippi. After a moment, he spoke up in a staccato voice. "Order army detachments to guard the bridge, day and night. Tell them to pick their best men for it. If anything happened to that bridge..." He did not finish. He sat hunched, staring down at the costly china plates and the delicate hors d'oeuvres before him. The absence of so prosaic a commodity as grapefruit juice had suddenly made real to him for the first time what it was that would happen to the city of New York if anything happened to the Taggart Bridge. "Dagny," said Eddie Willers that evening, "the bridge is not the only problem." He snapped on her desk lamp, which, in forced concentration on her work, she had neglected to turn on at the approach of dusk. "No transcontinental trains can leave San Francisco. One of the fighting factions out there, I don't know which one, has seized our terminal and imposed a departure tax on trains, meaning that they're holding trains for ransom. Our terminal manager has quit. Nobody knows what to do there now." "I can't leave New York," she answered stonily. "I know," he said softly. "That's why it's I who'll go there to straighten things out, at least to find a man to put in charge." "No, I don't want you to. It's too dangerous." "And what for? It doesn't matter now. There's nothing to save. It's still Taggart Transcontinental. I'll stand by it. Dagny, wherever you go, you'll always be able to build a railroad. I couldn't. I don't even want to make a new start, not anymore. Not after what I've seen." "You should. I can't. Let me do what I can."
"Eddie, don't you want..."
She stopped, knowing that it was useless.
"All right, Eddie, if you wish."
"I'm flying to California tonight. I've arranged for space on an army plane. I know that you will quit as soon as you can leave New York. You might be gone by the time I return. When you're ready, just go. Don't worry about me. Don't wait to tell me. Go as fast as you can. I'll say goodbye to you now." She rose to her feet. They stood facing each other. In the dim half-light of the office, the picture of Nathaniel Taggart hung on the wall between them. They were both seeing the years since that distant day when they had first learned to walk down the track of a railroad. He inclined his head and held it lowered for a long moment. She extended her hand.
"Goodbye, Eddie."
He clasped her hand firmly, not looking down at his fingers. He was looking at her face. He started to go, but stopped, turned to her and asked, his voice low but steady, neither as plea nor as despair, but as a last gesture of conscientious clarity to close a long ledger. "Dagny, did you know how I felt about you?"
"Yes,"
she said softly, realizing in this moment that she had known it, wordlessly, for years.
"I knew it."
"Goodbye, Dagny." The faint rumble of an underground train went through the walls of the building and swallowed the sound of the door closing after it. It was snowing next morning, and melting drops were like an icy cutting torch on the temples of Dr. Robert Stadler as he walked down the long corridor of the Wayne Falkland Hotel toward the door of the Royal Suite. Two husky men walked by his sides. They were from the Department of Morale Conditioning, but did not trouble to hide what method of conditioning they would welcome a chance to employ.
"Just remember Mr. Thompson's orders," one of them told him contemptuously. "One wrong squawk out of you, and you'll regret it, brother."
It was not the snow on his temples, thought Dr. Stadler. It was a burning pressure. It had been there since that scene last night when he had screamed to Mr. Thompson that he could not see John Galt. He had screamed in blind terror, begging a circle of impassive faces not to make him do it, sobbing that he would do anything but that. The faces had not condescended to argue or even to threaten him. They had merely given him orders. He had spent a sleepless night telling himself that he would not obey. But he was walking toward that door. The burning pressure on his temples and the faint dizzying nausea of unreality came from the fact that he could not recapture the sense of being Dr. Robert Stadler. He noticed the metallic gleam of the bayonets held by the guards at the door, and the sound of a key being turned in a lock. He found himself walking forward, and heard the door being locked behind him. Across the long room he saw John Galt sitting on the windowsill, a tall, slender figure in slacks and shirt, one leg slanting down to the floor, the other bent, his hands clasping his knee, his head of sun-streaked hair raised against a spread of gray sky. And suddenly Dr. Stadler saw the figure of a young boy sitting on the porch railing of his home, near the campus of the Patrick Henry University, with the sun on the chestnut hair of a head lifted against a spread of summer blue. And he heard the passionate intensity of his own voice, saying 22 years ago, "The only sacred value in the world, John, is the human mind, the inviolate human mind." And he cried to that boy's figure across the room and across the years, "I couldn't help it, John. I couldn't help it." He gripped the edge of a table between them for support and as a protective barrier, even though the figure on the windowsill had not moved. "I didn't bring you to this," he cried. "I didn't mean to. I couldn't help it. It's not what I intended. John, I'm not to blame for it. I'm not. I never had a chance against them. They own the world. They left me no place in it. What's reason to them? What's science? You don't know how deadly they are. You don't understand them. They don't think. They're mindless animals moved by irrational feelings, by their greedy, grasping, blind, unaccountable feelings. They seize whatever they want. That's all they know, that they want it, regardless of cause, effect, or logic. They want it, the bloody, grubbing pigs. The mind? Don't you know how futile it is, the mind against those mindless hordes? Our weapons are so helplessly, laughably childish. Truth, knowledge, reason, values, rights. Force is all they know. Force, fraud, and plunder. John, don't look at me like that. What could I do against their fists? I had to live, didn't I? It wasn't for myself. It was for the future of science. I had to be left alone. I had to be protected. I had to make terms with them. There's no way to live except on their terms. There isn't. Do you hear me? There isn't. What did you want me to do? Spend my life begging for jobs? Begging my inferiors for funds and endowments? Did you want my work to depend on the mercy of the ruffians who have a knack for making money? I had no time to compete with them for money or markets or any of their miserable material pursuits. Was that your idea of justice, that they should spend their money on liquor, yachts, and women while the priceless hours of my life were wasted for lack of scientific equipment? Persuasion? How could I persuade them? What language could I speak to men who don't think? You don't know how lonely I was, how starved for some spark of intelligence, how lonely and tired and helpless. Why should a mind like mine have to bargain with ignorant fools? They'd never contribute a penny to science. Why shouldn't they be forced? It wasn't you that I wanted to force. That gun was not aimed at the intellect. It wasn't aimed at men like you and me, only at mindless materialists. Why do you look at me that way? I had no choice. There isn't any choice except to beat them at their own game. Oh, yes, it is their game. They set the rules. What do we count, the few who can think? We can only hope to get by unnoticed and to trick them into serving our aims. Don't you know how noble a purpose it was, my vision of the future of science? Human knowledge set free of material bonds? An unlimited end, unrestricted by means? I am not a traitor, John, I'm not. I was serving the cause of the mind. What I saw ahead, what I wanted, what I felt, was not to be measured in their miserable dollars. I wanted a laboratory. I needed it. What do I care where it came from or how? I could do so much. I could reach such heights. Don't you have any pity? I wanted it. What if they had to be forced? Who are they to think anyway? Why did you teach them to rebel? It would have worked. If you hadn't withdrawn them, it would have worked, I tell you. It wouldn't be like this. Don't accuse me. We can't be guilty. All of us, for centuries, we can't be so totally wrong.
We're not to be damned. We had no choice. There is no other way to live on earth.
Why don't you answer me? What are you seeing? Are you thinking of that speech you made?
I don't want to think of it. It was only logic. One can't live by logic, do you hear me?
Don't look at me. You're asking the impossible.
Men can't exist your way. You permit no moments of weakness. You don't allow for human frailties or human feelings.
What do you want of us?
Rationality. 24 hours a day with no loophole, no rest, no escape. Don't look at me, goddamn you. I'm not afraid of you any longer, do you hear me? I am not afraid. Who are you to blame me, you miserable failure? Here's where your road has brought you. Here you are, caught, helpless, under guard, to be killed by those brutes at any moment. And you dare to accuse me of being impractical? Oh, yes, you're going to be killed. You won't win. You can't be allowed to win. You are the man who has to be destroyed.
Dr. Stadler's gasp was a muffled scream, as if the immobility of the figure on the windowsill had served as a silent reflector and had suddenly made him see the full meaning of his own words.
No,
moaned Dr. Stadler, moving his head from side to side to escape the unmoving green eyes.
No, no, no!
Galt's voice had the same unbending austerity as his eyes.
You have said everything I wanted to say to you.
Dr. Stadler banged his fists against the door. When it was opened, he ran out of the room. For 3 days, no one entered Galt's suite except the guards who brought his meals. Early on the evening of the fourth day, the door opened to admit Chick Morrison with two companions. Chick Morrison was dressed in dinner clothes, and his smile was nervous, but a shade more confident than usual. One of his companions was a valet. The other was a muscular man whose face seemed to clash with his tuxedo. It was a stony face with sleepy eyelids, pale, darting eyes, and a prizefighter's broken nose. His skull was shaved, except for a patch of faded blonde curls on top. He kept his right hand in the pocket of his trousers.
"You will please dress, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison persuasively, pointing to the door of the bedroom where a closet had been filled with expensive garments which Galt had not chosen to wear.
"You will please put on your dinner clothes," he added. "This is an order, Mr. Galt." Galt walked silently into the bedroom. The three men followed. Chick Morrison sat on the edge of a chair, starting and discarding one cigarette after another. The valet went through too many too courteous motions, helping Galt to dress, handing him his shirt studs, holding his coat. The muscular man stood in a corner, his hand in his pocket. No one said a word.
"You will please cooperate, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison when Galt was ready, and indicated the door with a courtly gesture of invitation to proceed.
So swiftly that no one could catch the motion of his hand, the muscular man was holding Galt's arm and pressing an invisible gun against his ribs.
"Don't make any false moves," he said in an expressionless voice.
"I never do," said Galt.
Chick Morrison opened the door. The valet stayed behind. The three figures in dinner clothes walked silently down the hall to the elevator. They remained silent in the elevator, the clicks of the flashing numbers above the door marking their downward progress. The elevator stopped on the mezzanine floor. Two armed soldiers preceded them, and two others followed as they walked through the long, dim corridors. The corridors were deserted except for armed sentinels posted at the turns. The muscular man's right arm was linked to Galt's left. The gun remained invisible to any possible observer. Galt felt the small pressure of the muzzle against his side. The pressure was expertly maintained, not to be felt as an impediment, and not to be forgotten for a moment. The corridor led to a wide, closed doorway. The soldiers seemed to melt away into the shadows when Chick Morrison's hand touched the doorknob. It was his hand that opened the door, but the sudden contrast of light and sound made it seem as if the door were flung open by an explosion. The light came from 300 bulbs in the blazing chandeliers of the grand ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel. The sound was the applause of 500 people. Chick Morrison led the way to the speaker's table raised on a platform above the tables filling the room. The people seemed to know without announcement that of the two figures following him, it was the tall, slender man with the gold-copper hair that they were applauding. His face had the same quality as the voice they had heard on the radio, calm, confident, and out of reach. The seat reserved for Galt was the place of honor in the center of the long table, with Mr. Thompson waiting for him at his right, and the muscular man slipping skillfully into the seat at his left, not relinquishing his arm or the pressure of the muzzle. The jewels on the naked shoulders of women carried the glitter of the chandeliers to the shadows of the tables crowded against the distant walls. The severe black and white of the men's figures rescued the room's style of solemnly regal luxury from the discordant slashes made by news cameras, microphones, and a dormant array of television equipment. The crowd was on its feet, applauding. Mr. Thompson was smiling and watching Galt's face with the eager, anxious look of an adult waiting for a child's reaction to a spectacularly generous gift. Galt sat facing the ovation, neither ignoring it nor responding. "The applause you're hearing," a radio announcer was yelling into a microphone in a corner of the room, "is in greeting to John Galt, who has just taken his place at the speaker's table. Yes, my friends, John Galt, in person, as those of you who can find a television set will have a chance to see for yourself in a short while." "I must remember where I am," thought Dagny, clenching her fists under the tablecloth, in the obscurity of a side table. It was hard to maintain a sense of double reality in the presence of Galt, 30 feet away from her. She felt that no danger or pain could exist in the world, so long as she could see his face. And simultaneously, an icy terror, when she looked at those who held him in their power, when she remembered the blind irrationality of the event they were staging. She fought to keep her facial muscles rigid, not to betray herself by a smile of happiness or by a scream of panic. She wondered how his eyes had been able to find her in that crowd. She had seen the brief pause of his glance, which no one else could notice. The glance had been more than a kiss. It had been a handshake of approval and support. He did not glance again in her direction. She could not force herself to look away. It was startling to see him in evening clothes, and more startling still that he wore them so naturally. He made them look like a work uniform of honor. His figure suggested the kind of banquet in the days of a distant past, where he would have been receiving an industrial award. Celebrations, she remembered her own words, with a stab of longing, should be only for those who have something to celebrate. She turned away. She struggled not to look at him too often, not to attract the attention of her companions. She had been placed at a table prominent enough to display her to the assembly, but obscure enough to keep her out of the line of Galt's sight, along with those who had incurred Galt's disfavor, with Dr. Ferris and Eugene Lawson. Her brother Jim, she noted, had been placed closer to the platform. She could see his sullen face among the nervous figures of Tinky Holloway, Fred Kennan, Dr. Simon Pritchett. The tortured faces strung out above the speaker's table were not succeeding in their efforts to hide that they looked like men enduring an ordeal. The calm of Galt's face seemed radiant among them. She wondered who was prisoner here and who was master. Her glance moved slowly down the lineup of his table. Mr. Thompson, Wesley Mooch, Chick Morrison, some generals, some members of the legislature, and preposterously, Mr. Moen, chosen as a bribe to Galt, as a symbol of big business. She glanced about the room looking for the face of Dr. Stadler. He was not present. The voices filling the room were like a fever chart, she thought. They kept darting too high and collapsing into patches of silence. The occasional spurts of someone's laughter broke off incompleted and attracted the shuddering turn of the heads at the neighboring tables. The faces were drawn and twisted by the most obvious and least dignified form of tension, by forced smiles. These people, she thought, knew not by means of their reason, but by means of their panic, that this banquet was the ultimate climax and the naked essence of their world. They knew that neither their god nor their guns could make this celebration mean what they were struggling to pretend it meant. She could not swallow the food that was placed before her. Her throat seemed closed by a rigid convulsion. She noticed that the others at her table were also merely pretending to eat. Dr. Ferris was the only one whose appetite seemed unaffected. When she saw a slush of ice cream in a crystal bowl before her, she noticed the sudden silence of the room and heard the screeching of the television machinery being dragged forward for action. Now, she thought, with a sinking sense of expectation, and knew that the same question mark was on every mind in the room. They were all staring at Galt. His face did not move or change. No one had to call for silence when Mr. Thompson waved to an announcer. The room did not seem to breathe. "Fellow citizens," the announcer cried into a microphone, "of this country, and of any other that's able to listen, from the grand ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel in New York City, we are bringing you the inauguration of the John Galt Plan." A rectangle of tensely bluish light appeared on the wall behind the speaker's table, a television screen to project for the guests the images which the country was now to see. "The John Galt Plan, for peace, prosperity, and profit," cried the announcer, while a shivering picture of the ballroom sprang into view on the screen. "The dawn of a new age, the product of a harmonious collaboration between the humanitarian spirit of our leaders and the scientific genius of John Galt. If your faith in the future has been undermined by vicious rumors, you may now see for yourself our happily united family of leadership. Ladies and gentlemen," as the television camera swooped down to the speaker's table, and the stupefied face of Mr. Moen filled the screen, "Mr. Horace Busby Moen, the American industrialist." The camera moved to an aged collection of facial muscles, shaped in imitation of a smile. "General of the Army, Whittington S. Thorpe." The camera, like an eye at a police lineup, moved from face to scarred face, scarred by the ravages of fear, of evasion, of despair, of uncertainty, of self-loathing, of guilt. "Majority Leader of the National Legislature, Mr. Lucian Phelps." "Mr. Wesley Mooch." "Mr. Thompson." The camera paused on Mr. Thompson. He gave a big grin to the nation, then turned and looked off-screen to his left with an air of triumphant expectancy. "Ladies and gentlemen," the announcer said solemnly, "John Galt." "Good God," thought Dagny. "What are they doing?" From the screen, the face of John Galt was looking at the nation, the face without pain or fear or guilt, implacable by virtue of serenity, invulnerable by virtue of self-esteem. This face, she thought, among those others? Whatever it is that they're planning, she thought, it's undone. Nothing more can or has to be said. There's the product of one code and of the other. There's the choice, and whoever is human will know it. "Mr. Galt's personal secretary," said the announcer, while the camera blurred hastily past the next face and went on. "Mr. Clarence Chick Morrison. Admiral Homer Dawley. Mr.—" She looked at the faces around her, wondering, did they see the contrast? Did they know it? Did they see him? Did they want him to be real? "This banquet," said Chick Morrison, who had taken over as master of ceremonies, "is in honor of the greatest figure of our time, the ablest producer, the man of the know-how, the new leader of our economy, John Galt. If you have heard his extraordinary radio speech, you can have no doubt that he can make things work. Now he is here to tell you that he will make them work for you. If you have been misled by those old-fashioned extremists who claimed that he would never join us, that no merger is possible between his way of life and ours, that it's either one or the other, tonight's event will prove to you that anything can be reconciled and united." Once they have seen him, thought Dagny, can they wish to look at anybody else? Once they know that he is possible, that this is what man can be, what else can they want to seek? Can they now feel any desire except to achieve in their souls what he has achieved in his? Or are they going to be stopped by the fact that the Mooches, the Morrisons, the Thompsons of the world had not chosen to achieve it? Are they going to regard the Mooches as the human, and him as the impossible? The camera was roving over the ballroom, flashing to the screen and to the country the faces of the prominent guests, the faces of the tensely watchful leaders, and once in a while the face of John Galt. He looked as if his perceptive eyes were studying the men outside this room, the men who were seeing him across the country. One could not tell whether he was listening. No reaction altered the composure of his face. "I am proud to pay tribute tonight," said the leader of the legislature, the next speaker, "to the greatest economic organizer the world has ever discovered, the most gifted administrator, the most brilliant planner, John Galt, the man who will save us. I am here to thank him in the name of the people." This, thought Dagny with a sickened amusement, was the spectacle of the sincerity of the dishonest, The most fraudulent part of the fraud was that they meant it. They were offering Galt the best that their view of existence could offer. They were trying to tempt him with that which was their dream of life's highest fulfillment. This spread of mindless adulation, the unreality of this enormous pretense, approval without standards, tribute without content, honor without causes, admiration without reasons, love without a code of values. "We have discarded all our petty differences," Wesley Mooch was now saying into the microphone. "All partisan opinions, all personal interests and selfish views, in order to serve under the selfless leadership of John Galt." "Why are they listening?" thought Dagny. "Don't they see the hallmark of death in those faces? And the hallmark of life in his? Which state do they wish to choose? Which state do they seek for mankind?" She looked at the faces in the ballroom. They were nervously blank. They showed nothing but the sagging weight of lethargy and the staleness of a chronic fear. They were looking at Galt and at Mooch, as if unable to perceive any difference between them, or to feel concern if a difference existed. Their empty, uncritical, unvaluing stare declaring, "Who am I to know?" She shuddered, remembering his sentence. The man who declares, "Who am I to know?" is declaring, "Who am I to live?" Did they care to live? She thought. They did not seem to care even for the effort of raising that question. She saw a few faces who seemed to care. They were looking at Galt with a desperate plea, with a wistfully tragic admiration, and with hands lying limply on the tables before them. These were the men who saw what he was, who lived in frustrated longing for his world. But tomorrow, if they saw him being murdered before them, their hands would hang as limply, and their eyes would look away, saying, "Who am I to act?" "Unity of action and purpose," said Mooch, "will bring us to a happier world." Mr. Thompson leaned toward Galt and whispered with an amiable smile, "You'll have to say a few words to the country later on after me." "No, no, not a long speech, just a sentence or two, no more. Just hello, folks, or something like that, so they'll recognize your voice." The faintly stressed pressure of the secretary's muzzle against Galt's side added a silent paragraph. Galt did not answer. "The John Galt plan," Wesley Mooch was saying, "will reconcile all conflicts. It will protect the property of the rich and give a greater share to the poor. It will cut down the burden of your taxes and provide you with more government benefits. It will lower prices and raise wages. It will give more freedom to the individual and strengthen the bonds of collective obligations. It will combine the efficiency of free enterprise with the generosity of a planned economy." Dagny observed some faces. It took her an effort fully to believe it, who were looking at Galt with hatred. Jim was one of them, she noted. When the image of Mooch held the screen, these faces were relaxed in bored contentment, which was not pleasure, but the comfort of license, of knowing that nothing was demanded of them and nothing was firm or certain. When the camera flashed the image of Galt, their lips grew tight and their features were sharpened by a look of peculiar caution. She felt with sudden certainty that they feared the precision of his face, the unyielding clarity of his features, the look of being an entity, a look of asserting existence. "They hate him for being himself," she thought, feeling a touch of cold horror, as the nature of their souls became real to her. "They hate him for his capacity to live." "Do they want to live?" she thought in self-mockery. Through the stunned numbness of her mind, she remembered the sound of his sentence, "The desire not to be anything is the desire not to be." It was now Mr. Thompson who was yelling into the microphone in his briskest and folksiest manner. "And I say to you, kick them in the teeth, all those doubters who are spreading disunity and fear. They told you that John Galt would never join us, didn't they? Well, here he is in person of his own free choice at this table and at the head of our state, ready, willing, and able to serve the people's cause. Don't you ever again, any of you, start doubting or running or giving up. Tomorrow is here today, and what a tomorrow! With 3 meals a day for everyone on earth, with a car in every garage, and with electric power given free, produced by some sort of a motor the like of which we've never seen. And all you have to do is just be patient a little while longer. Patience, faith, and unity, that's the recipe for progress. We must stand united among ourselves and united with the rest of the world as a great, big, happy family, all working for the good of all.
We have found a leader who will beat the record of our richest and busiest past. It's his love for mankind that has made him come here, to serve you, protect you, and take care of you. He has heard your pleas, and has answered the call of our common human duty. Every man is his brother's keeper. No man is an island unto himself. And now you will hear his voice. Now you will hear his own message. Ladies and gentlemen, he said solemnly, John Galt, to the collective family of mankind.